Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences at Loughborough University. In today's podcast, I'm joined by scholar, ultra-endurance athlete and multiple world record holder, Dr. Danny Longman. We'll be discussing Danny's experience as an endurance athlete, his multiple world records and his research focusing on the role of sport in helping to understand human evolution. Hi Danny, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Hi, thank you very much for the invitation. Nice to be here.
I'm really looking forward to some of the stuff we're going to talk about. So we are going to touch upon your research. We'll look at your experience as an ultra-endurance athlete and world record holder. But before we do, can you just provide us with a brief introduction of yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Danny Longman. I'm a lecturer in physiology here at Loughborough University, and my research focuses mainly within human evolution on adaptation and function in challenging environments. And alongside my research, as you mentioned, I'm really into ultra-endurance sports.
Brilliant. So I know, you know, this is the Experts in Sport podcast and we're bridging the gap between academia and professional practice, but I'm pretty sure everybody would want to hear first and foremost about your ultra endurance performances and in particular your world records. So how many world records do you currently have or have you had?
Currently it's 8 and a couple of fastest known times as well.
Perfect. So what are they? It's a challenge. Can you remember them all?
You know what? I can't. I can give you the highlights. So the most recent was the fastest rowing crossing of the Black Sea. That was last summer, 2022. And then the rest of Arctic exploration. One of them was the first rowing crossing of the Greenland Sea. Another was the highest latitude reached in an ocean rowing boat. And yeah, I can't remember the others, unfortunately.
Well, a couple of my favourites. This is from memory. I'm not actually reading from a script here. So from memory, I mean, what I think got you started seemed to be Mexico to Argentina. Was that 6 months unsupported cycling?
That was, yeah. So that was a wee trip after I finished my PhD. So a few weeks after submitting the corrected version of my thesis, flew out to Mexico City and, yeah, cycled down to Ushuaia, Argentina. Took 6 months or so and was absolutely stunning. And that kind of really opened my eyes to what's possible from an exploration point of view, just with human power, you know, on a bike and being able to use that to explore amazing parts of the world. And that really set me off down that new direction.
I saw a couple of photos of things from that. And certainly I showed my wife and we're both very jealous of that trip and some of those pictures you had. So that looked amazing. The other one that actually made me laugh, if this was true from what I read. So you've swam all, I think it's 13 publicly accessible lakes in the Lake District.
Yeah.
Yep. Now there was brackets twice next to this. Have you done that twice?
I have, yeah. So I did it first in 2019. I met a lad and I was in the Jordanian in the Wadi Rum Desert, sat next to a campfire one night doing field work at an ultramarathon, collecting data from the athletes. And a lad, Tom Elliott, his name was, he was a runner, one of the top runners in the race, came down, sat next to me and said, you know what, I'm not really a runner. I said, oh, you could have fooled me with this 250-kilometer desert race that you're doing. I said, no, I'm actually a swimmer. I do these ultra swimming events. I was like, okay, tell me about that. Anyway, by the end of the conversation, I'd agreed to accompany him on an ultra-endurance swimming attempt that summer. I'd never swum more than 2 kilometers at the local pool in any one go, but I thought, let's dive in. I'll learn from Tom. And yeah, that was what led us to the first attempt in 2019. That was cycling between the lakes as well. So we'd finish a lake, hop on our bikes, cycle for the next lake, swim that lake, a mate with a van and my dad as well would drive the bikes to the end of the lake and we'd continue. So that was great. That was in 2019. But then in 2020, someone beat the time. He was an actual swimmer, someone who'd had a background in swimming, but he drove between the lakes. He had a support team to drive him. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to have a go at that now. Like, can I beat that without cycling? So then in 2021, just as COVID was starting, things were starting to ease up. I got a bunch of mates together. We went up to the Lake District. They drove me between the lakes, which was, in one hand, a lot easier than cycling. But on the other hand, it meant a lot less time between the lakes. So sometimes I'd still be shivering as I got into the next lake because it might only be a 15-minute drive. So it was quicker. It was a lot quicker, but it wasn't that much easier.
That's it. So for our listeners, if you want to go and beat Danny's record, then he'll go and do it again. So I think we're getting that you are pretty competitive.
Yeah. Throughout high school and undergrad and PhD, I was involved with what you describe as the more traditional sports, your track and field, football, rugby, rowing, canoeing, that kind of thing, competing over your relatively short distances. And I loved the training. The training was great, but it was the competition that made me do it. This, the thrill of standing on the start line next to competitors who've been training all year, just like you, is great. And with these ultra endurance sports, it's a little, you have a little bit less of that head to head type competition. It's more about beating someone's time. But you can still get your competitive fix from that.
I mean, they all sound amazing. I mean, we've not even, you've mentioned them, but you know, rowing in the Arctic and rowing in the Black Sea just sound phenomenal and huge strength. You know, huge tests of endurance. We've not mentioned how long any of these events take. So in terms of endurance, what are we talking about? So just for context, the whole duration, but then splitting it into, you know, how long are you actually moving, I suppose, but want of a better word, in each of these events?
Sure, yeah. So the latest swim, the one that I did in 2021, so the distance was 71 kilometres, the cumulative distance of all 13 lakes, about 40 miles or so. And that includes Windermere, which was about 10 miles, 16K long. So that took 41 hours in total. So I started at 5 a.m. and then finished at 10 or 11 p.m. the next day. And that's pretty continuous. So Windermere, for example, took 5.5 hours to swim out the lake, into the car, drive to the next lake, go again. So that's kind of a little bit stop start because you're in the lake, then you're driving. But of the 41 hours, I was probably swimming for, I don't know, anywhere between 25 and 30 hours of that time. And that's at the shorter end of the scale. So 41 hours is probably the shortest event I've ever done. Black Sea, that was just under 10 days. That was 9 days and 18 hours, I think, in the end. The Arctic row was 13 or 14 days. And within the ocean rows, you're obviously not rowing continuously for 14 days, but you're rowing on and off in shifts. You row for 2 hours. Then you curl up in a small cabin at the end of the boat for 2 hours while your teammate rows. And then every 2 hours you shift, you swap shift. So you get a little bit of downtime, but unfortunately it's not the quality 12 hours rest that might suggest.
That's on and off for how many days? Sorry.
That was 14.
14 days on and off. 2 hours on, 2 hours off for 14 days.
Yeah.
Geez, and obviously in terms of sleep and things, are you getting much sleep within that?
Yeah. So, no, essentially you're not. So the Black Sea, that was, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. That's the one that's most recently in my mind. So you have 2 hours off where you get off shift. You have to wash. There's like kind of a personal admin routine you have to do to take care of your backside, essentially. So you don't get sores from sitting down in salt water for 12 hours a day. You then have to eat, obviously. And then by the time you manage to curl up and get your head down, you've probably got about 70 minutes to rest, but that's only twice a day because during the daytime, it's too hot to sleep. In the Arctic, we didn't have that problem, but it was too cold to sleep. And there's also chores on the boat. There's boat maintenance. So you probably get 2 70-minute naps in a 24-hour period.
Wow. And you managed to survive. And I think from things I've heard you speak about in the past, how did the events that you're doing lead to your research?
Back when I was a master's student, I was doing a human evolution master's course. I'd done biological natural sciences undergrad and then discovered human evolution. I thought that looks really interesting. It was back in the days before master's cost as much as they do now. So I was more able to give it a go, having saved some money in a summer job. Yeah, so I was in this course and I had this opportunity to take part in an Atlantic ocean row. So I was 21 at the time, incredibly naive, didn't really know what I was getting myself into, but the row itself was really eye-opening, and it was my experiences on the row that led to the research. Essentially, when I started off, we set sail from Gran Canaria heading for Barbados, and I had images of Caribbean beaches and dolphins in my mind and totally, totally unprepared for what was about to happen. I was intensely, violently seasick after my first 2 hour shift. For the first 3 or 4 days, I didn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I had no idea how I was going to get through this crossing. And what really interesting thing that happened was after about 3 or 4 days, I did start to sleep a little bit. I did start to eat a little bit, and my strength actually started to come back whilst I was rowing, and I could feel my mind clearing. I was pulling harder at the oars. And this was really strange because everything I'd always been taught by my various sports coaches throughout high school, throughout undergrad at university, was that in order to recover and regain strength after physical activity, after training, you had to rest. Rest was, you know, the hallmark of every training program I'd ever been on. But here on this trip with this 2 hours on, 2 hours off shift pattern, there was no scope for meaningful recovery at all. And yet I was recovering. I was regaining strength. So when I got back to university, I went to my supervisor and told him about this. I said, hey, this is really cool. I think we need to study this. And obviously my own ideas as a master's student were fairly unsophisticated at that point. We had a bunch of meetings with him, with a few of his colleagues. And eventually it took shape and became the research program that I've been working on since.
That's brilliant. I'm glad you mentioned unsophisticated because, as I mentioned to you previously, I may ask some unsophisticated questions. other guests in the past, I do explain that, you know, I have enough knowledge in areas to be dangerous, as in I might think I know more than I do. So I can ask the questions that hopefully maybe some of our listeners are asking. I've got a bit of a broad knowledge. Obviously, I've had a look and read your research, and it is really fascinating. Interesting as well, whilst you're touching upon that, your ultra endurance events kind of brought you towards the research side. For listeners who've listened to a few of the podcasts, I have done a podcast with Tom Evans, ultra endurance runner. I don't know if you have you done any work with Tom? Have you met Tom at all?
Unfortunately not, no. I've read about a lot of his exploits. Incredibly impressive guy, but I've never met him, unfortunately.
Yeah, good guy. Cool stories. Little cool stories like you. Like, essentially, pretty much to get him started, it was a bet with his mate that he could just beat him. And he did. And he trains on campus. I think he may still train on campus. He certainly was training on campus at Loughborough. So the other one is Ross Edgeley. Do you know Ross at all?
Yeah, I've met Ross a few times. We overlap with swimming a little bit. He's an interesting character. He's a great lad. And he's, yeah, really, really nice guy.
Well, he's obviously Loughborough alumni. So I've met him at one of the careers events that we run. I've not done a podcast with him. I may have to harass him for that. But I was thinking around your competitiveness, and he's very competitive. I was thinking if there was anyone you could throw the challenge to swim the lakes quicker than you, it might be Ross. Although he does say he's not a swimmer, but he has swam around the whole British Isles.
Yes.
So I think both of those would probably be interesting, potentially research and potentially endurance. So yeah, let me know afterwards. And anyone listening, go check out Ross's book or go and check out the podcast with Tom Evans if people want to. So let's move forward onto your research and the general research in this area. So can you just explain a little bit around what, you know, human evolution is and how sport is enabling you to kind of discover more about human evolution?
Yeah. So evolution is essentially how species develop. It's the process by which species become what they are today and will become what they will be in the future. Human evolution is then the development of our species. So focus on humans specifically. So my background, as I mentioned before, is in human evolution. I studied master's, PhD, postdoc in this area. And so over the last 10 years or so, we've developed this idea of using sport as a model to study human evolution. And we defined this new subdiscipline of human evolution a couple of years ago in a paper and termed it human athletic paleobiology. So essentially the idea is that you can study contemporary sports and recruit athletes as a model to study mechanisms of human evolution. And this can be done in a wide range of ways by looking at the developments of species as a whole, by looking at how people vary into individually. You know, we're not all the same. Why do these variations exist? But then also looking within the individual in terms of why do we respond the way we do within a lifetime? How do we adapt within a lifetime without the need for genetic change? So it's an area essentially that's gained a lot of traction. There's quite a few people working on this now around the world, and it's quite exciting. It offers quite a few new areas for study, mostly because we can test living people. So most study within human evolution is looking at skeletal remains, trying to work out how we developed over time, or it works with primates, you know, with our closest living relatives, chimpanzees, etc. But this offers the unique advantage of working with living humans and really increases the richness of the measurements that you can take as a result. So yeah, it's quite a fun area, and it means that I can work with ultra endurance athletes in cool places around the world, which is obviously a bit of a plus as well.
Yeah, nice way to focus your research. Sorry, I've just got to go away to this place for a month. Brilliant, or two. So why specifically is it better or beneficial to be using athletes as opposed to general population? What's the benefit there?
That's a really good question. And this is one of the key hallmarks of this, because As a society, I'm sure your listeners are aware, we are becoming increasingly sedentary. We are nowhere near as physically active as we used to be. If you go back only 600 generations within the human species, only 600 generations ago, every human on the planet was a hunter-gatherer, which means that we were hunting, we were digging for nuts, we were physically active by necessity every day. That then gave way to farming, which again, with the advent of farming, we went roaming quite so far, we had greater food security, but at the same time, incredibly active. If you ever meet a farmer, they're incredibly fit people. But since industrialization came in over the last 200 to 300 years, we've become increasingly sedentary, and we now have diseases of physical inactivity, which were never an issue in the past. So one of the benefits of studying athletes today is that athletes tend to have a physical activity profile that's more representative of our ancestral past. It's a subset within contemporary society of people who are as active as our ancestors used to be. And for that reason, as well as others, they're a really good model for looking at ancestral populations. Obviously, the type of physical activity is different. You know, people in the past were not running 10K tempo runs in the morning and lifting weights in the afternoon. It was a different type of physical activity. It wasn't exercise per se. It was more activity with a purpose. But nonetheless, they're still athletes are still a much, much better model than your average sedentary office worker, for example.
I think I read from some of your research, one of your papers, that I think somebody else's research within your paper, that runners, so hunter-gatherers, I think it was 80 to 100 miles a day. Sorry, a week, not a day. 80 to 100 miles a week is what they typically covered. So that's kind of highlighting what you just said there. So you're looking for athletes who are covering potentially similar distances to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the key areas that I'm interested in with my research specifically is looking at how we respond to energetic stress. Now, from an evolutionary point of view, our trajectory, the evolutionary journey that we've taken, can be described as one that's characterized by repeated cycles of dispersal and colonization of new environments. And that's essentially how we left, how various subgroups of modern humans left sub-Saharan Africa, and we colonized the majority of the world before too long. And we did this by colonizing and by dispersing. And this brings with it inherent food insecurity. You know, if you're colonizing a new area, you're not necessarily completely familiar with the food availability, with what food you can get at different times of year. So this food insecurity is a repeated kind of feature within human evolution. And we believe that we've developed various mechanisms to deal with energetic stress. And if we want to study how we respond to energetic stress, as I mentioned, your average office worker who's perhaps consuming more calories than they need in a given day, they're not going to be a good model for that. But ultra endurance athletes, or endurance athletes more generally, they do push the limits of their energetic margins. So they regularly run into conditions of energetic stress, whether it's through increasing training load, whether it's through their nutrition not quite being adequate, or more likely some combination of the two. So for that reason as well, athletes are a really nice group for studying mechanisms that we've developed through our evolutionary past.
Yeah, let's get into some of the specifics of your research then around that energy. And obviously you're talking historically, people may have had limited supply of energy. And then you talked about kind of the distribution of energy. So what specifically is going on, and what are the theories that you've been working on through your research?
Yeah, so there's an evolutionary concept called life history theory, which essentially just tries to explain why organisms are the way they are. And in so doing, life history theory views every living species as being an evolutionary solution to an environmental problem. By that, what I mean is that we all represent all of our features, all of our morphological and physiological features were driven by the environment. We are adapted to thrive in a given environment. So life history theory essentially visualizes species, including humans, as capturing energy from the environment via eating, in our case, and then allocating that energy between different physiological functions. And the functions that we prioritize will vary by life stage. For example, as a child, you'll be investing more in growth and less in reproductive function, for example. During adolescence, that switches. Reproduction becomes more important. Growth subsides. And then throughout life, essentially, the allocation patterns will vary. And what we're really interested in with our ongoing research is trying to understand how we allocate energy, essentially, when we don't have enough. So when you're under conditions of energetic stress due to, in contemporary society, it might be because you're an athlete who's pushing training particularly hard, or it might be because you're in a war zone or there's forced migration, displacement, there might be famine. So there's quite significant public health implications for this as well. So essentially, yeah, what we're trying to do is work out which systems are prioritized at all costs, you know, which physiological systems do you absolutely need, but then at the same time, which can be sacrificed in order to promote survival until you enter a more energetically favorable environment, for example.
With this research, so what have you been finding? I know I've had a look at a few of your papers. So, for example, you've got a paper on short-term resource allocation during extensive athletic competition. What did you do there? What did you find?
Yeah, so this was the very first study we did. This was essentially trying to prove the concept that we could use ultra endurance races. This was a 100-mile ultra marathon in the North Downs Way, I believe it was, just south of London. And this was to try and prove the idea that we could use ultra marathons to observe trade-offs in resource allocation. So hopefully that we could observe some systems being prioritized and others being sacrificed. And thankfully we could. We had some very clear results. And what we found in this study, this study recruited only men, because unfortunately this race had, I think, 90% male entrance rate, which is something I wasn't aware of before this event. We've since targeted events with a more 50-50 gender balance. But in this particular race, what we found was that reproductive function, as measured by testosterone levels and libido, plummeted, went right down. So reproductive function was sacrificed quite significantly. But at the same time, immune function was really ramped up. We didn't just see a preservation in markers of immune activity, we actually saw an increase. So there was a really stark redirection of energetic resources from reproductive function towards immune function in this particular study, which has clear survival value to it. If you're in an environment that's very energy poor, perhaps reproduction isn't the thing you need to be focusing on. It's more looking after yourself, not getting sick and surviving until, as I mentioned, you get to an environment that's a little bit more energetically favorable.
That's really interesting in terms of the kind of survival traits, because, again, my knowledge that's dangerous would suggest that respiratory diseases and things like that are diseases, viruses and infections and things are more prevalent in athletes and highly trained athletes. So would that conflict with that, or am I missing something there?
No, that's a really interesting point. Yeah. So any athlete who takes part in a kind of strenuous, prolonged training regime, you see upper respiratory tract infections, just sore throats, developing, I guess, if it gets worse, to chest infections. They're really common. I found this myself when I was doing rowing training. You know, it's everyone. There was always someone coughing in the boathouse, which sent shivers of fear through everybody else that everyone was going to get sick. So, yeah, essentially, we're trying to understand the difference here. So what we found was, in a very acute time span, so this is over the course of a 100-mile race, which for the good athletes lasts 20, 24 hours, for the more recreational athletes, 36 hours. So over this acute, very short time span, there's an increase in immune function. But what we see with athletes is over a more prolonged training regime, there seems to be a bit of immune suppression. So we're not quite clear at the moment where the crossover happens, at what point it starts to become immunosuppressive. But in the short term, it seems to be beneficial for the immune function. Yeah,
that'd be a really interesting to find out that. And I suppose going back to some of your things around energy, whether it's related to, you know, longer term energy deficits or things like that would be quite interesting. Because I know you mentioned as well around, we touched upon it around sleep and not needing as much sleep. Would that be linked to, you know, ensuring you do have enough energy? As in you're eating enough and therefore you can carry on and get stronger? Or where does that come in terms of, are you, you know, like marathon runners, you might carb load, for example. Are you ultra carb loading, and to what extent, like pre-race, pre-event? But also, are you overcompensating within the event? So if you're going to be burning 10,000 calories, are you trying to eat 10,000 calories? Are you trying to eat 12,000 calories, for example?
Yeah, so I think firstly, with regards to sleep, on a lot of these ultra endurance trips, expeditions that I've been on, for example, the ocean rowing, where you're sleeping like two and a half hours a day, that's not good. You know, there's a whole range of research showing unequivocally that sleep is necessary for health, for longevity, for cognitive performance, for physical performance. That's absolutely the case. But what I think I've found just through my own experiences and from teammates on these expeditions is that your body can get through a certain amount of time with limited sleep. So it's almost as though it, the way it feels to just, to me, at least when I'm on these expeditions, it's almost as though your body goes into a kind of survival mode whereby all non-essential systems will be shut down, and you can feel it. You can feel hormonal fluctuations. You can feel cognitively that certain you're very aware of your environment. You're very susceptible to, you notice your very small changes in air temperature that might, or slight changes in wind speed that might signal a storm is coming. You really clue into that. But at the same time, if someone asked me to reason through a research problem, I wouldn't have a chance. So there's definitely a redistribution of resources that I think get you through. But I'm sure if those conditions persisted for too long, if that lack of sleep went on for too long, you would ultimately lead into you'd have difficulties. And related to the food that you mentioned there with regards to calorie consumption, in a lot of ultra endurance competitions, it's just not possible to consume as many calories as you're burning. So if you're a runner taking part in, for example, a 100 mile race, you're going to be burning upwards of 10,000 calories during that time, most likely, and there's no way you can consume that. But over a short time period, you can run an energy deficit. It's okay, you'll have a little bit of fat reserves that you can burn through. And when you go for the longer trips like ocean rows that last a number of weeks, at that point you need to gain the weight in advance. So for example, in the polar row, I lost a kilo a day for 2 weeks. So I came back 14 kilos lighter. And thankfully I managed to take a photo. A teammate took a photo of me without my shirt on both before and after, just because we thought this might happen and we really wanted to see. And it was hugely different. It was really interesting how that could happen. Within 2 weeks, I went from being slightly on the chubby side to being really quite skinny afterwards. So yeah, with regards to events like that, I find it's really about preloading food and then just hoping your fat reserves have enough energy to get you through.
Just on that, on the being slightly chubby side, that was purposeful, I think.
From previous conversations,
you put that weight on ready for the event.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
But good calculations then. I think you said, I'm sure you said to me before, you put 14 kilos on, so you lost 40 kilos. So good maths.
Yeah. I thought my standard baseline weight is I probably have about, I'm about 87, 88 kilos. I'm 6'2", which is, I guess, fairly, it's not too skinny, but like I have enough reserves, about 10% body fat or so. So enough reserves to keep me going for a couple of days, but not too many. I can get quite thin quite quickly if I'm not careful with food. So yeah, that weight gain in advance was very necessary.
And potentially enjoyable at the time.
You know what? You'd have thought so, wouldn't you? The first day or two it was, but after a couple of days, it's just not fun. You're constantly full. I remember at university when I was training for the first one, the polar row, I said to a number of friends, I gave a few friends a couple of pounds each and said, look, can you just always have a chocolate bar on you? And if you see me, if you pass me in a corridor, just stop me, give me this chocolate bar, make me eat it. And I would actively avoid them. If I saw a friend down the corridor, I'd take a detour, just got sick and tired of eating. And I actually got to the point with that I stalled, actually. I got up to about 94-95 kilos and I just couldn't put on any more weight. My day felt saturated with food, and I was thinking, gosh, I need to get closer to 100, otherwise I might struggle here. I just couldn't do it. So one evening I had the realization that the night time when I was sleeping, that was an untapped resource. There was 8 to 9 hours there when I just wasn't eating. So I set my alarm for 3 a.m. and I'd wake up at 3, have one of those I don't know if you know saurine malt loaves.
We
used to eat as kids, you'd slice them and put butter on. So I take one of those.
I need to give a shout out to a coach who works in our gym called Joseph. He survives on saurine. He loves it. So perfect. Yes, I know it well.
Food of champions. So I'd wake up in the middle of the night, cut one of them in half, squish it down, put it in the toaster, put a load of butter on it, eat that. And that was, I don't know, I think that was probably about 700-800 kilocalories. Go back to sleep. And after 3 or 4 weeks of doing that, the kilos started piling on. So that was what got me up to the 100. But yeah, eating to put on weight like that, it's not as fun as it sounds, unfortunately.
And there's a lot of people struggle with it, having had a background of working with athletes and general population. And obviously the traditional thing of bodybuilders was setting your alarm, getting up in the night and eating. Some don't do it that way anymore, but many probably still do. So no, really interesting, slight aside, but you know, not quite. We need energy to do these kind of ultra endurance events. You were mentioning that your cognitive type function. I know you've done some actual research on this, and it sounds like it's, you know, the research has stemmed from your experiences. So I think you had a paper called A Trade-Off Between Cognitive and Physical Performance with Relative Preservation of Brain Function. And I like the selfish brain hypothesis. So can you talk us through that study and what you found there?
Absolutely. So there's an evolutionary theory, as you mentioned there, called the selfish brain hypothesis, which states that the brain essentially controls energy supply within the body. The brain controls which systems get energy. But the brain will always prioritize its own energy over that of other systems, hence the idea of the selfish brain hypothesis. And this is potentially a uniquely human phenomenon. And the idea is that throughout our evolution, we have developed enlarged brains compared to other species. We have created this cognitive niche in which we survive. And this is very visible, actually, if you just look at ourselves compared to other species. You know, we are weak. We are pathetic physical specimens compared to most animals. We wouldn't survive in the UK without technology, without clothes, without fire. It would simply be too cold in winter. So it's through these cognitive advances that we have been able to create technological advances that allow us to survive in parts of the world that we do. So in this particular study, we were very interested in looking at energy allocation in a very short time span. So if we took cognitive function and if we took physical function and we stressed both at the same time, which would be prioritized? So we had people do a series of experiments. One of them was a cognitive task. One of them was a physical task, which was on a rowing machine to row as hard as you could for 3 minutes. So very intensive task. And then we had people do both at the same time. So they would be rowing whilst trying to perform this cognitive task. And what we found was that cognitive function was relatively preserved, but physical function really decreased. And this happened in quite a large sample size of participants. And this, we found this really interesting because it really supported this selfish brain hypothesis and the idea that as a species within this cognitive niche that I mentioned that we've developed for ourselves, we're much more likely to survive an environmental challenge with a well-fueled brain to be able to think our way out of the problem than with well-fueled muscles to be able to fight our way out of the problem. So that was the main finding there.
So no, that's really interesting. I had a question from looking through your research, and I don't know if this has been looked at all, but you talk about obviously cognitive function and when you're talking about energy there. And I know some of your research and some of the other research that you sent towards me spoke about other research around endurance athletes. My interesting question is, do we know in terms of human evolution and survival of the species, whether kind of endurance athletes or those kind of who evolved more for endurance, were they more able to survive longer and thrive more than other populations that might not have developed that endurance? Is that why everybody was hunter-gatherers, or does that make sense?
So yeah, it does.
Brain over brawn or strength and endurance, where does that sit in evolution?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And there's a professor, he's the head of anthropology at Harvard University, Dan Lieberman, who's quite well known. A few of your readers might have heard of. He was very involved with the barefoot running movement. He's known as the barefoot running professor, and he's done a lot of work in this area. And the idea is essentially that humans, we have quite uniquely actually specialized to become endurance type athletes rather than power type athletes. And this is probably the best way to visualize this is if you think about running speed. So sprinting is very much a power-based activity. You can see this if you look at Olympic athletes on the TV. They're incredibly muscular, the athletes who do the 100 meters. And if we think of our sprinting ability as a species, we are pathetic. We can be out-sprinted by a small, round, fluffy bunny rabbit. Most things can outrun us on the short distance. But if you look at for a long distance, humans start to become very good. Compared to our primate relatives, so chimpanzees, gorillas, etc., we are actually unique amongst primates in the ability to run long distance using aerobic metabolism. So we can run long distances without building up any oxygen debt, without building up lactic acid. And that's really unique about humans. And there's a really strong body of evidence within the evolutionary literature pioneered by Dan Lieberman, the Harvard professor I mentioned a few minutes ago, which argues that there were unique selective pressures that benefited humans who were able to perform endurance running, such as particular modes of hunting that were then available to us that involved chasing down gazelles, antelopes, gemsbok, kudu, etc., during the hottest time of day, often distances exceeding 10, 20, even 30 or 40 kilometers. So if you were able to do this, there were definite fitness payoffs in terms of acquiring resources. So yeah, the idea is there that for that we have developed to become endurance specialists.
You've answered my question. So yeah, the research is out there. You mentioned the barefoot running, and I know we were going to talk about this a little bit. Now you've got a paper on human athletic paleobiology, so using sport as a model to investigate human evolutionary adaptation. And so I know some of this paper's got some research from other people. What research is there out there already? And I know one of them is around barefoot running, which a lot of people know a little about. So can you explain that to us in this context?
Absolutely, yeah. So this idea of human athletic paleobiology, of using sport to study evolution, has been mainly applied on three different levels. The first level would be at the level of the evolution of a species as a whole. The second level would be looking at inter-individual differences. So that is considering within the human species, why do people differ from each other? And the third is the intra-individual level. So looking at the level of the individual, how you may vary over a lifetime. So the barefoot running really fits in under the species level evolution. And there's a lot of work that's been performed in this area by others looking at how we have evolved as a species. So how we differ, for example, from Neanderthals who have lived at the same time as us, we're very similar genetically and morphologically, how we differ from chimpanzees, for example, as well. One of the main selective pressures that have led to morphological differences between us and other species relates to running ability. We've evolved to be endurance runners. And there's a really interesting series of papers that have come out of Harvard University looking at barefoot running. And this led to the whole barefoot running movement, which I'm sure a lot of people are aware of. Basic idea here is that we have a number of skeletal and muscular and tendinous adaptations that allow us to run long distances in an incredibly efficient way. And our feet are fantastically designed for this. For example, the plantar tendon that runs from the base of the big toe to the heel, and the Achilles tendon, which runs from the heel up the back of the leg. These tendons are able to give you 50% of your energy that you put into each step back to you. They act like springs to propel you through the next step. And the idea with the barefoot running movement here is that by putting on a really built up, highly cushioned shoe, you actually negate a few of these advantages that your body has to be able to run long distances. You actually remove the evolutionary advantages that we've developed over the years. So by running barefoot, you allow the foot to act as it evolved to do. And therefore, you can enjoy the advantages of barefoot running. So that's the theory. I'm not an advocate or an opponent of this at all. My research hasn't focused in this area. And a lot of people do barefoot running very successfully. But yeah, there's some really interesting evolutionary theory that goes into this.
I think the book that I read was Born to Run. So I think anybody who's seen this has read Born to Run and talking about the Tarahumara tribe and how they evolved. I think a lot of people would know that. So if not, go and read Born to Run. Interestingly, I've also done a podcast almost on the other side of this around the running shoes and carbon plates being in shoes, which is pretty much trying to replicate what you talked about that we already have. It's quite an interesting one. But yeah, certainly don't go crazy going barefoot running straight away, because I think there's many people got injured from doing that. But it is certainly, there is some evidence out there that it's pretty beneficial. I think there's other evidence from your paper as well around other adaptations from throwing as well. So can you just touch upon that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in our past, spear throwing was very important as a means of hunting. It was a new technology that we'd invented that allowed us to be able to kill prey that were potentially dangerous to us. If you're trying to hunt an antelope, you know, they're big. They can hurt you. So to be able to kill it from a distance with a spear was a huge technological advantage. And the reason why we spoke about this spear throwing and javelin throwing study in the paper that you mentioned was that this was a great example of why it's important to study athletes to get an insight into human evolution, because there was a study published a few years ago where they recruited normal members of the public, gave them spears and asked them to hit a target that was a distance 10, 15 meters away. And they couldn't do it. They were unable to throw this spear at this target. And the conclusion of this study was that, hey, this wasn't feasible. Our ancestors would not have been able to do this. This method of hunting with the spear would not have been an effective way to catch animals. However, given a little bit more deep thought, obviously, if this was necessary to your survival to be able to do this. You would be practicing this from early childhood, right? You'd grow up with a spear in your hand. You'd become an expert spear thrower. So Anne-Marie Milks, who is based down in London, she realized this and she repeated the study, but with trained javelin throwers who were therefore more indicative, more representative of our ancestors in this respect. She gave these spears. She had replica spears that Neanderthals would have used in the past made, gave them to these javelin throwers. Surprise, surprise, the javelin throwers were very good at this. They were able to hit the target. In fact, they were able to hit the target when it was even further away and with much greater force as well. So this then led to the conclusion that, hey, yeah, this is a feasible method of hunting. This, we can see how Neanderthals would have been able to do this. So this really highlighted the importance of sampling. Like, who do you recruit for your study? You need to recruit participants who are reflective and are representative of the population that you are trying to understand. So this was part of our, this study we used as part of our argument that recruiting athletes as opposed to sedentary office workers are much more representative of our ancestors.
It's a really good example of why the study population is really important and how, you know, you can use this for your research. So thanks for going through, you know, all that research, the past research and your research. What our listeners often want to know is, you know, how can they benefit from this research? So how is this research moving from research into practice?
Yeah, really nice question. So I think with regards to how this can be applied to benefit the public, it's still very much in its conceptual phase right now. It's what we call basic research, just trying to understand things based on curiosity. However, the theoretical frameworks that we're developing here do have really strong implications for public health in the future. There's a really interesting emerging area at the moment called evolutionary public health, which is essentially taking lessons from evolutionary theory to try to understand health in a contemporary context. So we're still a couple of steps away from me being able to give two or three bullet points to enhance the lives of your listeners, unfortunately, but hopefully we'll get there in the next 5 to 10 years.
But certainly endurance athletes can take away some key points from your research.
Yes, good point. So from an endurance point of view, I think that one of the things that's really helped me and could well help the endurance athletes that you have listening to this would be the fact that when you're energetically stressed during an event like this, your body will change. As I'm sure your listeners are aware, you will be aware of hormonal fluctuations. You'll be aware of cognitive changes. You'll be aware of your digestive system suddenly speeding up or suddenly slowing down for no apparent reason at all. Now, the key take-home message that I would say that I've taken from my research as an endurance athlete is that all of these changes are adaptive. Your body is doing what it needs to do to prioritize energy supply to your essential processes, your essential physiology. So when you feel changes happening, essentially my advice would be don't worry too much about it. It's what your body is doing, what it's evolved to do. And assuming that you don't push yourself too far, obviously there is a limit to this. When you recover, when you start to eat, when you enter more of an energy surplus type situation, the changes will be reversible and you will revert back to how you were at baseline. So this knowledge has really helped me as an athlete. For example, during the ultra swimming event I did a year and a half ago at 3 a.m. Swimming down Alls Water in the pitch black in the Lake District, I was being sick. I couldn't eat or anything. I couldn't drink. I could feel lots of changes happening within my body, but I knew that however awful it felt, it was reversible. As soon as I finished, within a few hours of having some food, a good sleep, I'd feel fine again. And that really gave me the confidence to press on. So hopefully your listeners can take something from that.
I hope so. I mean, I ran a marathon in Sydney years and years ago, and I remember everybody talking about hitting the wall. And I was like, damn, I won't hit the wall. Just get on with it, was my attitude. Anyway, the first time I ran about 30K, which is where a lot of people might say you're hitting the wall, 30, 35K, I was running in Centennial Park, it's in Randwick in Sydney, and it's a place where a lot of people run. But I'd done 25K plus before I got there, and all these people are running, looking great. I don't know what I look like, but I do remember I was running, and in my head I was like, there is no wall. I had to scream for about 5 seconds, just a big, ah, and just carried on running. That was my way of psychologically dealing with the pain I was experiencing for the first time. So, yeah. Nice advice on just keep going is essentially that advice.
Yeah.
So moving on, what's your future? What's your future research plans to start with?
Yeah, so we're really interested in understanding how people vary in their response to energetic stress. So at the moment, we're just characterizing how humans in general respond, which systems are prioritized, which are sacrificed. But there's likely to be a huge degree of inter-individual variation by age, by sex, by body type, by ethnicity, for example. All of these things may well affect how we respond to energetic stress. So that's something we're really interested in. And another research strand that I've been developing over the last year or so is actually looking at how environment affects physical function. And the idea here is that we evolved in nature. So for 99.9% of our evolutionary history, natural environments set the parameters that shaped natural selection and therefore shaped and drove the species that we are today. Whereas the last 200 to 300 years, we've moved to cities and we're now living in an environment that essentially our physiology is not adapted to. There's a mismatch here between our physiology and the environment that we live in. So we're really interested in developing an understanding of how this affects us, how this affects levels of stress, which we do know are much higher in urban areas than in natural areas, but also how it affects things like cognitive function, immune function, reproductive function, and physical function. And I had a PhD student and a few master's students last year looking at physical function, and we found actually that endurance performance increased significantly after a visit to a forest compared to after a visit to a city, a town centre. And these are results that we're still unpicking. We haven't published yet, but I think this could be a cool avenue for investigation going forward.
Brilliant. So any researchers that are out there, I know we're keen on kind of growing collaborations within our own department and across different kind of research functions. So I'm sure if anybody wants to get in touch, then you know you can find Danny on our website. You can get in touch with me and I can put you in contact with him. So I'm sure also our listeners are interested to know what crazy world record of attempts you might be doing in the future. Do you have any plans for the future? Are you got any ideas where you might be going, or is it yet to be revealed?
Yeah, yet to be revealed, to be honest. There's a few possibilities at the moment. But with expeditions like this, 90% of them don't actually happen. You have these initial discussions. Your teammate will reach out to you and say, hey, Dan, we're planning this expedition. We think we'd really like you to be involved. And for whatever reason, financial, logistical, people's lives getting in the way, these things don't happen. So there's a few possibilities, a few irons in the fire right now, but nothing quite developed enough to announce.
But I know that some of them in the past, you have had some sponsorship from people. So who have you been sponsored by in the past that have helped some of these logistical and financial challenges?
Yeah, so I've been very lucky to work with Helly Hansen for the last 5 or 6 years or so. They're a Norwegian outdoor clothing brand who make really high quality gear for harsh environments. So they've been kitting me and my teammates out for a couple of years now and helping us make contacts with the people we need to be able to make the logistical arrangements for these expeditions. So Helly Hansen have been absolutely fantastic. And another big side of things is obviously the nutritional side. So we're really hoping to have been using Huel essentially over the last few expeditions. So if anyone from Huel happens to be listening and would like to send me a few bags for my next expedition, that would be very much appreciated. I survived almost exclusively on Huel during the Black Sea Row. A few bags would go down nicely.
That's amazing. So we'll make sure we thank Helly Hansen from you and see if they they want to sponsor you to do anything else. And we'll try and tag Huel in and see if they fancy sponsoring you, seeing as though you've given them a shout out already. let's see if they want. And then hopefully you can come back and say, actually, I was funded because of the podcast, and you can give us an exclusive all around what happened on your next adventure.
Sounds like a plan.
Brilliant. Danny, it's been really, really good to speak to you. Really appreciate your time. And I hope our listeners have really got something from learning a little bit more about evolutionary adaptations. And hopefully they'll understand the use of sports people, and really look forward to the future research you bring to potentially bring this into the public health sphere as well.
Absolutely. Thanks for your interest. It's always great to chat to interested people.
No problem. Well, we'll speak to you again soon. Thanks, Danny.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Experts in Sport podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, then please contact me, Martin Foster, at m.foster@alborough.ac.uk. Thanks for listening. See you next time.